It's the Steve Fast Show on WJBC. The impact of human life on the global ecosystem is unique. Up until the 1800s and the industrial age, people adapted to their environment. Then, over a two-century span, humans began to alter nature itself with technology, creation, and often pollution. Author and naturalist Diane Ackerman has written about the geologic impact of humankind in her best-selling books, such as A Natural History of the Senses, which was turned into a PBS series. Her latest book, The Human Age, investigates the future of humans and the Earth in an era when we have more impact than any other species throughout all of the planet's history. And we welcome Diane Ackerman to the show. Diane, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
The title of your book, The Human Age, is referred to with a different term, the Anthropocene Age. When did the Anthropocene Age start, and what does it mean?
Well, when it started is a very good question, because that's being debated right now and will be decided by 2016, when the name change will almost certainly be official. Some people, well, first let me say that humans have been on the planet for about 200,000 years, but all of the wonders that we associate with everyday life really came about in the last 200 years. And in the last 20 years, the human saga has been advancing at a mind-boggling pace. So it is to honor our dominion over the entire planet that scientists are hoping to change the name of our geologic era to the Anthropocene, which means the human age. And the question, as I say, is when? Did we start it with agriculture? Did we start it with the Industrial Revolution? That's my vote. Some people say maybe the atom bomb. But there's no question that around the year 1800, around the Industrial Revolution, we started using fossil fuels and started huge factory farms and just changing the landscape in a way that no other creature ever has in the entire history of the planet.
The way you framed it there was, you said, humankind's, I guess, dominion over the Earth in a way. You say that humans jumped the line in the food chain. How did that happen?
Well, that's true. We're not really faster than other animals, and we're not better armored than other animals. We're not fiercer. What we are is mindier. And at a certain point, unlike the other animals, we just stopped adapting to the environment and started making up tools and finding ways to rebel against the environment. And now we're at such a point, we have so much mastery over the planet, that there is no inch of it that hasn't been touched by us. We've left our signature everywhere, even in the natural parks and the areas we think we've left wild. If you look closely, you discover that the evolution of the plants and animals all has been affected by us.
Much of the discussion of the human impact on nature in modern times is centered around climate change. Is the human impact on the planet of burning carbon unique?
Certainly. We are doing this in a way that no other animal has. We've been tampering with the whole big baggy climate, also the oceans. We've been acidifying the oceans, and there's a lot of coral reefs that are dying. We've been moving plants and animals around and creating invasive species in different places. We've been paving over a lot of natural habitats for animals. There is no other creature that has done this. I mean, it would be majestic enough just to be able to create our giant megacities, which we've done, and build our nests high up in skyscrapers, which we've done. But to generally vex and bother every plant and animal on every continent and in every ocean is an altogether different caliber of niche building. This is quite unique, and we are at a very important stage in our evolution as a species, because we have all of this power, but ironically, we're discovering that it could work against us and that we need to be more aware of what we are doing. Now, people most often, when they hear about all of this, say, oh my God, we are doomed, because the headlines are just full of gloom. But I don't feel that way at all. I think that we have a lot of planetary chaos that we need to answer for and try to repair. And climate change is absolutely real and it's urgent and we need to address it immediately, but we're not helpless. We're not hopeless.
So is the effect of all of this power that people have to affect change upon the geosphere necessarily negative? When you hear people talk about climate change, it's usually in negative terms. But are there things, for instance, that a warmer world means that is not necessarily bad, it's just different?
Well, for sure, it will be different, and it will affect some parts of the globe more than others. Some parts of the globe probably will benefit from it, but most people will not, especially if the sea levels rise. The important thing, though, to remember is that we've already proven that we can change the planet, and we kind of messed up things. But imagine if we decided on purpose this time to change the planet for the better. We can work together as one species, and there are many really inspiring efforts that are taking place right now in all different countries, at the international level, at the national level, at the individual level, to help people adapt to climate change and to ease it. The UN panel on climate change, really the experts on this, have said climate change is real, but it is technologically possible for us to curb it and make sure it doesn't get any worse. The real question is whether it's politically feasible, and that's something that we have to work on.
We're talking with Diane Ackerman. Her new book is called The Human Age, The World Shaped by Us. Let's talk about some of these innovators, not necessarily people that are working hand in hand for global change to combat some of the effects of, for instance, rising sea temperatures and rising sea levels, but there are smaller groups of people, some of them working in conjunction with government, some of them not, who are trying new things. And one thing that I thought was particularly interesting was a new approach towards alternative energy. And in Sweden, there's actually an interesting example of this, of how this conglomeration that we see, these cities are warmer than the countryside. There's all those people giving off all that heat, and they're using it there.
They are. People are finding really creative forms of renewable energy. And as you say, one of them is gathering body heat. And it's not just in Sweden. They're also doing it in France in the subway stations and some other places. But in Sweden, in the train station, as commuters are bustling around, each person gives off about 100 watts of energy, and that is being drafted down underground to heat water, which is then piped across the street to provide warmth for the office building that is there. And as I say, this is also happening in the subways in France, and people elsewhere are discovering they can gather the wind that's given off by passing trains and have it spin turbines that produce energy. There are really ingenious things that are happening, and Sweden is managing to recycle about 99% of its household waste. So there is an example of what we could do and what we need to do, because in the West, we're using more resources than people anyplace else in the world.
Well, speaking of resources, some of these innovators you write about in coastal areas that are most likely to be affected by climate change and by rising sea levels are actually using ocean life to adapt to these rising tides. You write about a couple of them. I didn't realize the impact that oysters could have in combating the effects of climate change.
Oysters are actually very important because oyster reefs used to line all the coastlines, and we've lost like 85% of them. But the great thing about oyster beds is that when hurricanes come in, they crash on the oyster reefs, and it breaks up the surges before they can rush down the estuaries. And so there are people who are out there constructing artificial beds, some of them of oysters, some of them of other things. And the idea is, along our coast, but also elsewhere in the world, to set up more of these. And one of the people that you meet in the book is a pioneer of the Blue Revolution who wants to switch us as much as possible away from the big factory farms because they use a lot of resources, and think in terms of the ocean, where you could have three-dimensional farming, very small footprint, and that's what he does in the Long Island Sound. And you're growing algae and oysters and mussels and all different kinds of things. That's one person. You meet other kinds of people who are making a big difference also. In Bangladesh, for instance, there's a man, an architect, who decided to found a nonprofit in which he would launch 100 boats with very flat bottoms that would go out across the floodplain in flood season, and they would provide schools and hospitals and agricultural areas for the people whose land had been flooded away more so than ever by climate change. He's now touching the lives of 90,000 people.
When you talk about the power that people have in this Anthropocene age to contend with some of the effects of the changing world, which, you know, we're kind of creating, there are some controversial approaches which may indeed, when applied properly, be part of a new world when we see some of these climates change drastically. There's a big concern with climate change over drought and desert. And many people say that the solution to that is to use our understanding of GMO crops to make more productive and resilient crops for some of those areas. Is this something that we don't quite have a grasp on, or are we concerned about GMOs in a way that affect the tomatoes that we see in the grocery store as opposed to the grains that we might see in, you know, sub-Saharan Africa?
People have very extreme views on GMOs. You're quite right. And there's good and bad elements of them. Some people in Africa, I've heard say, talk to us about GMO problems once we've had enough food to eat. In other places, they're terribly concerned about the monopoly that companies have over these genetically modified crops. In other places, they're worried about what happens if genetically modified animals are loose in the environment. So the whole genetically modified question has different sides that we're going to need to have to explore. For example, the Tasmanian devil is a personal favorite. There are very few of them left because they have facial cancer. However, we do know what the gene is that causes it. Somebody could reach into their genome, genetically modify that, and get rid of the cancer. That would be a good thing. I think we would agree on that. On the other hand, do we really need tomatoes that have the genes of salmon in them? But you can buy those. They're not to make them redder, it's to help with the cold. Or do you really need to have pets that can fluoresce green in the dark? You can buy fish like that. The question of how it's used is going to be important, and what type. But even if there's no health problem from GMOs, one of the biggest problems right now is the control over them, such that very few types of seeds are being bred by Monsanto, big companies like that, and they're being given to farmers in an infertile variety so that the farmers can't just keep the seeds and plant them. They have to go buy new ones each year. So there are different kinds of problems around the GMO issue.
When you look at the ability to have that much control over big swaths of our environment, is that something that is going to require a massive cultural mindset when the idea of the most monetarily productive thing to do is to create a monoculture, the same kind of corn or the same kind of soybeans or whatever grain in one big area? That doesn't necessarily help diversify things for long-term adaptation and survival. But that seems to be what our whole system is geared towards. I mean, it's short-term productivity, but a long-term lack of adaptation.
Yes, that's true. But we are waking up to that. The fact that you're even asking that question, and that I've been writing about such things, and that people have been speaking out about it, and that 400,000 people met in New York to protest recently, all of these things are signals that the world is waking up to what we are doing to nature, or how we relate to nature, and how that's really been changing. And that is really what my book is about, not just climate change, but how our own nature is changing and how we need to not just have techno fixes to fix the environment. We need to have a change in our society, in our industry, and in our way of thinking. And there are a number of industries right now that really have taken that to heart and are doing important things. For example, Nestle Company announced recently that they're going to stop buying palm oil for their Kit Kat bars from Indonesia because the Indonesian rainforests have been decimated in order to plant palm. And along with that, a lot of biodiversity is gone. A lot of employment for locals is gone. And so Nestle has said, nope, we're going green. IKEA, the furniture company, has recently launched a very ambitious program in which they're working with indigenous peoples in the Amazon to help preserve the resources in the rainforest and make sure that the wood that they are using, that IKEA is using, comes only from renewable sources. Coke and Pepsi are collaborating. So even our companies are starting to get the message that there will be no future if they don't start working together, and that it is a very dignified and, well, something that's good for PR to be green. Also, it's financially better for them. Saudi Arabia, the oil market of the world, exports oil, but actually in its own country, it is switching over to renewables because they're cheaper.
One final thing. We touched on this a little bit earlier when you were mentioning the issue with the Tasmanian devil and the possibility to locate the part of that creature's genome that is causing an issue, a genetic problem. When you get into this entire sort of Jurassic Park concept, how feasible is that for the ability of humans to alter which animals that may be on the brink of extinction or may be extinct will be that way?
We are deciding now. We have already decided to a large extent what animals we want to share the planet with. Think about, picture the wolf, and then picture all of the pet dogs that we have that look nothing like the wolf. We have systematically been breeding our preferred traits and behaviors into all of the animals around us. And importantly, we've been doing that to ourselves without realizing it and changing our own nature as well. We just assume now that human beings can see things microscopically or can fly across the sky at 500 miles an hour. That has become natural for human beings. And this is, I want to emphasize that this is not all negative. Many of the things that we have been doing and are able to do are extremely positive, and we are going to be able to repair a lot of damage that we've done. We're going to be able to create brand new ways of living on the planet and working together. I think we are at an important turning in our evolution as a species.
How important will it be, you know, there's that fantastic science fiction concept of the fact that we can somehow bring back a woolly mammoth or something along those lines.
But would you like a woolly mammoth?
You know, I think I'd like it for a while until I had to clean up after it. It'd be fun for a weekend.
Well, one of the trips that I make in the book is to the frozen ark where they're storing the DNA of extinct, endangered animals all over the planet. And the idea is that either they will be able to bring them back, or they'll be able to enrich the gene pool of these dwindling numbers that we have now. And in theory, we could bring back a woolly mammoth, but that would involve more problems, because suddenly you'd have this woolly mammoth fetus inside of an elephant, right, who would bring it to term, but then it would be born, and the elephant would be really surprised. It wouldn't sound like an elephant. It wouldn't look like an elephant. It would have the same culture of a woolly mammoth. So it would be a woolly mammoth, but not exactly. And it might outcompete the other animals, in which case it would be an invasive species, but not from some place else, some time else. And that would be quite a curiosity. So we have a lot of ethical predicaments that we are going to have to take a few moments out and think about in the coming years.
Would there be a benefit more so with the same sort of technology in trying to ensure the lifespan of certain plant life? There's such a concern with the disappearing rainforest, and so many medicines have been found out of things that have been cultured out of plant life. Is that something that is more feasible in the impact that we might have using that sort of technology?
Actually, crop seeds are probably the most feasible in that way. In the case of rainforest, we need to make sure that the locals are making enough money that they can become guardians of their own rainforest, and that countries are protecting rainforests so that we don't lose them. That's critically important. But in the case of crops, we have so few crops now compared to what we used to have. We had hundreds of varieties of all the different vegetables and so on, and we have fewer and fewer and fewer. And so there is a seed vault in Norway that is storing seeds and has been for a while now from all over the planet. This is just something they're doing for free for the sake of the world. And when needed, we can go different countries and start again with some of these other seeds when we need more biodiversity.
Diane Ackerman's new book is called The Human Age, The World Shaped by Us, and we've been talking with her this hour. Diane, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back after this. It's the Steve Fast Show on WJBC.